Byram Bridle is with us now. He is a professor of, an associate professor of viral immunology. Byram, I forget what university you're at.
The University of Guelph in Ontario in Canada.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How have you been lately?
Holding up. Yep. Mm-hmm. The negative pressure has been withering, but in my institution, we have a vaccine mandate that's been put into place, and so I can't go onto campus, my university campus, for at least the next year. And I've seen many students and staff members who have had to be escorted off of our campus because they were not vaccinated. They're still rounding up people who aren't vaccinated, and for staff, they're being put on unpaid leaves. And for students, they're being kicked out of their programs. Some have, to avoid this, saw this coming and have delayed their programs by a year, or simply taken a year off mm-hmm. of their university education. But yeah, on my campus, it's a very poisoned environment. Certainly for myself personally, I have colleagues who have been viciously attacking me incessantly, name calling, accusing me of like making false accusations against me in the social media realm. It's been terrible. And the interesting thing now, well, actually, so in light of this, these negative pressures against me exploded, absolutely exploded after I gave a few minute interview, right? It was to a lay audience. And it was in that interview that I guess that was the first time that I talked openly about, the findings that I had made, because I keep up to date on the scientific literature when it comes to vaccines, because I'm a vaccinologist. And I had come to the very, solid conclusion that this current batch of vaccines, and again, I point out, the definition of vaccines has changed, certainly officially. Officially in North America, it's been changed to legitimize, the current products that we're using, from Pfizer and Moderna and Johnson & Johnson and AstraZeneca. And but at the time, right now, it still bewilders me because I'm still under this withering attack from colleagues and some members of the public. Although I'll tell you, I'm receiving overwhelming support from the public as well. Right? They many know what's going on, but the vast majority of people are just too afraid to speak up. But in this interview, which again, it's remarkable as a scientist that other scientists would do this to a fellow scientist. Right? I was asked one question by a radio show host. And they were just doing their job, and I was just doing my job, right? I'm a public servant. I work at a publicly funded institution. My salary is paid for by taxpayers. And so, one of my jobs as a public servant with deep expertise in the fields of immunology and virology is to answer the public's questions related to those topics, right, in which I have sufficient expertise. And this person asked me, so at the time, it was a story that had come out of Israel, and specifically, 12 young males had been identified in Israel who had developed heart inflammation shortly after receiving the Pfizer vaccine. And this person simply asked me, did I see a potential link between the Pfizer vaccine and this heart inflammation that was occurring? And my answer was yes, I did see the potential for that. And then I went on to relay the likely mechanisms of harm that could explain why that would be the case. And this was based on science. And of course, with it only being a few minute interval, I was cut off. To this date, some people, I remember a fact checker saying that, in that interview, I only told half the story. And to this day, still kind of half jokingly laugh about that. If only I was able to tell half the story. I probably told less than 1% of the story. and yet I was fact checked by so many people about this incredibly narrow part of the story that I was actually able to share in that radio interview. But lo and behold, in Canada, we're always going to be one of the last countries in the world to identify any harms with these vaccines because of how our reporting system works. It or doesn't work. It's an awful adverse event reporting system in Canada, just awful. However, here we are all these months later, and I was told that I was lying, that it was all misinformation that I was providing. And of course, we saw all the public messaging that was occurring around the world that there wasn't a link to heart inflammation, countries denying that. Well, you can only hide something that's quite common for so long. And remarkably, my own, so again, I live in the province of Ontario in the country of Canada. So the government of my province, so the Ontario provincial government, just officially released yesterday, they made an announcement that the Moderna vaccine should no longer be used in young males in Canada because of the high risk of heart inflammation. And they've also admitted, so they're still recommending the Pfizer vaccine, but recognizing the official numbers. So the official numbers that came out, and I'm sure these are likely a gross underestimate of the problem. But nevertheless, the Ontario government stated yesterday that the risk of heart inflammation in young males in Canada was 1 in 5,000, and for the Pfizer vaccine, 1 in 28,000. So they're recommending the Pfizer vaccine. But the point is, they're openly acknowledging that this is a problem in young people, and yet to this day, I still am being attacked incessantly because of that message. And what frustrates me is the fact that, as a scientist, I when this announcement came out yesterday, Reiner, I'll tell you, I was flooded with emails. I guess I should correct that. It was actually 2 days ago now that this announcement came out. But I was flooded with emails from people, especially members of the public, but other colleagues who have been supportive and so on, telling me, like, this is amazing. How did you foresee this, right? Like, now it's being officially announced. And there's nothing remarkable about it, right? I'm not some kind of fortune teller. I'm a scientist who follows the science. And, if one is following the science, it became blatantly obvious to me months ago that these vaccines are causing things like heart inflammation. And so it really disturbs me that so many people have had to be harmed. Right, there's had to be such an overwhelming and obvious number of people harmed in order for our governments to officially recognize this, and yet they have scientists who are experts in this area for whom it was obvious, and we would have argued, like an individual like myself would have argued, these things should have not have been used months ago, and we would have saved all these people all of this harm. So that's sort of how my life is going right at the moment. It's, I'm standing strong because I'm a scientist who just simply, I've done nothing different. I'm doing nothing different now than I have throughout my career as a scientist, right? I'm giving the same messaging. I'm evaluating the science in the same way. And when there are issues for which I have sufficient expertise to comment on, and I'm asked to comment on them, I provide that information. I provide it bluntly and honestly, and nothing has changed, but the world has changed around us, right? And the amount of censorship that's happening in Canada is absolutely profound, to the point where I was actually one of our members of parliament, and so his name is Derek Sloan. He was one of our federal ministers of parliament, so a member of our federal government, and he hosted a conference on a news conference on Parliament Hill. So this is at the building where our government rules the country of Canada, and there was myself and another physician and a fellow scientist, and three of us, and we presented. And our government has an official, the short form for it is CPAC. It's a cable service that carries all official broadcasts for our federal government. And we spoke out about censorship, and the police that provide security for the building tried to prevent this from happening. this presentation about censorship, remarkably. So before it even started, there was an attempt to censor us. When we showed up, there was no mainstream media whatsoever. They didn't even bother showing up to this official parliamentary press conference. It was crazy. I couldn't believe that I was in the capital of my country. And but we gave this presentation. It ended up being the most, like, it broke all records by a country mile. It ended up being the most watched government video, like, in the history of this cable, service. And it was carried on YouTube, and YouTube allowed it. It's typical of YouTube, right? They allowed the views to explode. It hit this record, became the most viewed one ever, and then they pulled it. They censored it, right? It was unbelievable. They actually censored an official parliamentary press conference about censorship. And in fact, it's even worse than that, because during the live broadcast, it was being broadcast live on YouTube, and YouTube shut down the live feed. It was about halfway through me speaking at the conference. But then there was a second feed that was able to get up and running. But so even during the live presentation, they shut it down. And I have to point out, just the other individual, the other physician who was there in person with me presenting, his name is Dr. Patrick Phillips. He is a physician who practices in a small town in the northern part of the province that I live in. He has been under relentless attack since then, and he has been absolutely brutalized by our, it's called the CPSO, the College of Physicians and Surgeons of Ontario. The tyranny that they are exercising on the physicians in our province is like nothing that I've ever seen. They just recently and very publicly attacked him viciously. They have withdrawn his ability to prescribe ivermectin, for example. And he was one of the few physicians in Canada who openly recognized and the overwhelming science in support of that as an effective early treatment, and was using it as a practicing physician very effectively. This is where the dangers are unbelievable, because he of government interference, because he was keeping people out of the hospitals, right? Where many, our government has constantly been complaining about how COVID-19 is filling up our emergency rooms and our ICU units. And he was keeping people, his patients, out of the hospital and healthy during this. And they were not dying, his patients that were getting COVID-19. They've actually pulled his ability to prescribe that. And actually, this vicious attack came out because very recently, particularly because he attended a worldwide freedom rally. And that was the egregious offense, that he attended this rally. And those rallies in Canada have been labeled as being directly opposing public health. And therefore, as a physician, simply by attending this meeting, they accused him of opposing public health measures. And that, is an egregious act by a physician to do so. He's in terrible trouble right at the moment. Lawyers have surrounded him and tried to help. But this is what's going on. I have another colleague. Her name is Dr. Julie Panessi. A video that she did actually went viral around the world. She's an ethics professor at another university close to me, University of Western Ontario. So it's only about an hour and a half away from where I work. And she was made an example. So this Patrick Phillips has been made a very public example for the physicians. This Dr. Julie Panessi has been made a very public figure for, in the context of our colleges and universities in Canada. So she was very unceremoniously dismissed by her institution, and has lost her job completely as a faculty member after serving them for over 20 years as an ethics professor. And so it's unbelievable, because she refused. This is because she didn't get vaccinated based on sound ethical principles. So here's an ethics professor not wanting to get vaccinated because she has done her she did a very well-informed cost-benefit analysis, came to the conclusion that it didn't make sense for her to be vaccinated because she felt it would be put her at greater risk, and she lost her job because of it, standing up, an ethics professor standing on the foundation of ethics. So this is what it's like in Canada. I'll tell you, I really feel for our brothers and sisters in especially Australia right now. I mean, that what I can't even believe that that is the same country that that existed, you know, a couple of years ago. I'll also tell you, I've been in close communication with colleagues in New Zealand as well. It's just awful there. But I'll tell you, Canada has been a world leader in many of the wrong ways, especially when it comes to the COVID-19 vaccines. And it's awful here in Canada. Not as bad as Australia, New Zealand. That's why I really feel for them. But absolutely awful here. I mean, we're notorious for leading the world with decisions like with on no apparent scientific basis, lengthening the recommended interval, the approved interval for the vaccines, these two-dose vaccines, from 3 to 4 weeks, right, depending on which of the ones, which one you're using, to a ridiculous 4 months with no scientific basis, right? And then the other thing that we've led the world in was the original mixing of the different vaccine types as well. I just don't. It's unbelievable. One of the reasons I'll tell you why this is happening. So I've started speaking very bluntly about this, Reiner. What I'm going to say at the moment, because I'm not a person who likes to offend anybody at any time. But as I put it, the time has come to take off the kid gloves now. And the public needs to be aware of how the scientific and medical system works exactly. And so this is the problem as I see it in many countries, and certainly in Canada. There are far too many people, policymakers, right, who are pushing these many tyrannical COVID-19 policies on people who simply lack the expertise. Now, so specifically, and what I can specifically comment on is in the area of immunology. So vaccinology is a subdiscipline of immunology. And yet I see a complete lack of immunologists involved in the vast majority of the committees that are making these decisions. So, for example, in my own local, what we call public health unit, right? So we have a medical officer of health assigned to small regions. And so there's many of them throughout Canada, and each one covers a certain region. So my local medical officer of health has what she refers to as her scientific advisory committee, providing advice in terms of the policies that she institutes in our region. Her scientific, so encompassed in that is my university, myself, a couple of other senior immunologists on my campus, and others offered to serve on this committee and be able to provide our deep expertise, right, so, from different scientific perspectives, virology and immunology being key topics that we can cover. They refused. So her entire, quote, scientific committee consists of nothing, 100% family physicians. And again, I have absolutely nothing against family physicians. But this goes right up to the top in Canada. So in Canada, we have a committee. It's known as the NACI, which stands for the National Advisory Committee on Immunization. This is our committee that advises our government. So they are the ones that give out all, you know, the advice that ultimately leads to the policies that get applied to our entire country. Now, so again, a National Advisory Committee on Immunization. So since it's focused on immunization, you would think it would be loaded with immunologists and people who have advanced training, advanced degrees in immunology. In fact, when you look at our committee membership, there's actually only one person who clearly you can identify has an advanced degree. They have a PhD in immunology. And then there's another one who's a clinical immunologist. So I would assume that they have some formal advanced training in immunology, but a degree like that is not listed. Surely from clinical practice, at least, and from residency, they would have received, you know, a good amount of training. But those are the only two individuals on this large committee that I can identify who likely have advanced training in immunology. So this was actually recognized, you know, I'd say they took far too long to recognize it. But at least eventually they did recognize that they had this complete and utter lack of immunology expertise on a committee that's making decisions that are entirely based on immunological principles, right? So they actually recruited from across Canada. They advertised and accepted applications from senior immunologists across Canada. And they did recruit two immunologists to the committee. Because what I should point out is the one person who holds a PhD in immunology, their purpose of serving on the committee wasn't even to comment on the immunology. They were actually recruited to the committee to provide expertise in the area of pediatric public health. Not specifically to apply their training in immunology in the context of immunological principles on the committee, but of course they could comment on that, but they weren't even recruited for that purpose. So they did recruit two immunologists specifically to focus on the immunology, which again is the key science underlying vaccinology. But you know what was crazy, and Canadians, still aren't even aware of this. Those two immunologists were placed on the committee, but they were given non-voting roles. So all the existing committee are there, the voting members, and these two immunologists who are there to comment on the vaccinology, the science underpinning the vaccine specifically, and they have non-voting roles on this committee. So you can see in Canada, from the top down, we're not set up at all to be able to comment properly. And so you can see, I don't want to judge anybody's expertise, but the reality is most of the people that are involved, most of the committees that are involved in decision making are completely lacking in expertise when it comes to vaccines. And what people have to understand, right, people are going to their physicians, and the physicians right now, this comes back, for example, to our College of Physicians and Surgeons of Ontario, but this applies across the entire country in Canada, they're officially recommending that and discouraging physicians from issuing medical exemptions for vaccines. So people with valid medical reasons. So this is the kind of thing that's happening, the kind of decisions that are being made. And so people are going to their physicians who are being discouraged from issuing these exemptions. These physicians have also been fed, a very narrow public health narrative. And the reality is they lack the expertise. So the average physician in Canada lacks the expertise to be able to critically assess any information to do with vaccines. And the reason is this. People assume, Canadians especially, assume that physicians must know, they must have a deep understanding of immunology. I'm always profoundly surprised, right, with how little, and to me, this has to change in Canada and all countries moving forward. Physicians in Canada receive exceptionally little training in the field of immunology. In our medical schools, we average to get the medical doctorate, students average between 5 to about 12 lectures total in the MD program focused on immunology, which means that in the context of vaccinology, they're receiving on average less than one lecture's worth of material, well less than one lecture's worth of material on vaccines. And so what this means is they don't understand the science like in any kind of depth. The average undergraduate student at my institution receives at least three times as much training in immunology as somebody in the MD program. It's phenomenal to me. And yet these are the people who prescribe vaccines, administer vaccines to our children, right? So the average physician, and again, I don't mean to be offensive, but I just want to be blunt and real here because people have to really ask the questions, who is it that's giving me this information and how much expertise do they actually have in this area? So the average physician in Canada who holds a medical doctorate has exceptionally little training in immunology. And when it comes to vaccines, okay, I'm just going to be blunt again about this, right? Really where their strength lies is applying these recipes, these protocols, right? They get information about, a vaccine, the condition that it should be and under which the conditions under which it should be used, what it should be applied for, how to administer it and so on. They follow the directions provided by the manufacturer, and they don't have the depth of knowledge to really understand, do proper cost benefit analyses and so on, and really to be able to critically assess any type of vaccine. That's the reality, and that's what we're dealing with in Canada. And people need to realize that when they're relying on these, quotes, experts, they really are not experts when it comes to vaccines. Absolutely not.
And how can something like that happen? I mean, this is very strange, because you would think that in such a problematic situation, the government would really, in a normal situation, reach out for the best and profound experts in the field. And even for international, look for international help if there's
absolutely
no super experts in the country.
Absolutely. Yeah. I have no idea. It's completely illogical. What I would say is what we need, if we can ever get back into any semblance of normalcy, and I don't, like, that's not where we're headed. I definitely feel we're going to start applying all of these same principles, the masking, the physical distancing, and the forced vaccinations to influenza virus. That's what I feel is going to happen if things aren't stopped fairly quickly. So I hear you. I have no idea. I have no idea why we're doing that. And that's why I want to point that out, because this is important for the world to understand. Because I know when Canada, for example, especially when Canada went to the sudden, elongation of the interval to 4 months with the vaccines, many countries in the world who were dealing with vaccine shortages and still are, were looking to us saying, well, where's your data? Could you please show us your data? Because if this looks good, we'll do the same thing, because we're dealing with vaccine shortages. We didn't have the data to show. And in fact, this committee, this National Advisory Committee on Immunization, it was very embarrassing to justify this scientifically. They published their scientific rationale for doing this in a journal that nobody's ever even heard of, and you can't get access to internationally. It's this little publication that came out of our University of Toronto, which is fairly close to the institution I'm at, and it's an embarrassment. But they claimed it underwent peer review. I contacted this journal that I'd never heard of, even though it was being published about an hour away from my institution, and I asked. I said, my understanding is this paper underwent peer review. Usually, when these types of papers are published, journals will tell you when the paper was submitted, when it was accepted, and when it was published. And so I knew, because I was the one who actually, along with two of my colleagues, had been really pushing our National Advisory Committee on Immunization to show us this science. And it was in response to an open letter that we wrote that they produced this paper. So I knew the timing. And it seemed to me that in terms of the peer review, the maximum time that they probably could have devoted to peer review was about 3 days. Because of the timing of the communications we were having. So I contacted the journal, and I wanted to know, could you tell me when was this paper submitted and how long did the peer review process take? They completely ignored me, right? So it's this horrible paper in a journal that is not ranked. You'll never find it on the PubMed database, for example. International scientists can't find it. And that's, quotes, the scientific justification. And I will tell you, so here's an example of, this is a paper that would never get published in any decent scientific journal. They have one figure in it that shows the results of an epidemiological model that they used. And everything in Canada, all of our policies have been based on these epidemiological models, right? And everybody wants to know, what are these models? Can we see the raw data? What information are you plugging into them? Well, in this paper, you go to the materials and methods, they do not describe. In fact, they openly state that, there's another publication in the works that will describe the model. So you don't even know what the model is, but we just have to trust that the model is excellent, right? And then here's the results of running that model, which show that a four-month interval should be this fabulous thing, right? So I'm telling you, Reiner, because Canada was the first to do this, and other countries looking to us, right? This is the garbage science on which it was based. Right, and to set a precedent for other countries, and just to show how crazy that was, because this is the thing: people don't have to understand science anymore. They just have to exercise a little bit of common sense and look around and ask some, simple questions, and be open to looking for honest answers. So, when this happened, one of the other things that was really upsetting for us was the justification for going to a four-month interval was a misconception that the one dose, that a single dose of the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines in particular was 90%, that these were 90% effective after a first dose. And again, this was an example that they were setting, you know, for the world to go to these intervals. And the justification was we can go to 4 months because guess what? You're only compromising the effectiveness just by a hair, right? We were told that the effectiveness of the two-dose regimen was 95%. So 90% is very impressive, to the point where you have to start arguing, if that's true, why would we even bother with the two doses? But this came from a complete fallacy as well. This was an epidemiologist who took Pfizer's own data and reported, you know what, Pfizer didn't realize the gold they were sitting on. They did not analyze their own data set properly. I reanalyzed it, this epidemiologist told Canadians, right, and found that, in fact, the effectiveness after one dose is this incredible 90%. Well, it was a complete garbage analysis, but everybody in Canada bought it. All the health officials bought it. Our National Advisory Committee on Immunization bought it, and that's why we went to this four-month interval. What people don't realize, This was published in a letter to the editor of the journal BMJ, formerly British Medical Journal, highly respected journal. But this is not peer reviewed science at all. It was just published in a letter to the editor, and that became the foundation for us doing this. Right beside that, Pfizer, as is the case when somebody is making a comment about somebody else's data set work, the people who generate the other data set have the opportunity to respond to that, and that can get published alongside it. So indeed, Pfizer themselves published alongside this letter a note of their own saying, we don't agree with this analysis at all. You know, we recommend is a, you know, two-dose regimen with a three-week interval in between. That's it. It was incredible. Yet we ran with this idea of 90% effectiveness. And now, of course, this is the thing, the contradictions, when you start doing this with science, when you don't actually practice science properly, you end up with all kinds of contradictions that start becoming obvious. So right now, one of the reasons why the vaccine mandates are being pushed on us, right, and we're seeing this worldwide, all of a sudden, we went in Canada from telling everybody one dose is fabulous. We called it this. We had, you know, we just came out of our summer in Canada. We were infamous for, we referred to our summer as the one dose summer, right? That was the goal. Get every Canadian one dose, right? And then they're going to be beautifully protected. Then we'll work on topping it up, you know, from 90% effectiveness to 95 with the second dose. And we don't have to rush that. Now, you aren't even categorized as vaccinated in Canada. Unless you have two doses, and you have to be more than 2 weeks out from the two doses, right? Or you're considered unvaccinated. So again, I just say to people, look around you and look at how we're mismanaging these vaccines. You were told that one dose was just about as good as two doses. And now you're being told that even after the second dose up to, you have to be, 15 days out from that second dose now to be categorized as vaccinated. It's unbelievable. And even with that definition. Yeah, absolutely.
Because you speak of effectiveness of 90%, but you mean this is the relative risk reduction, which is named, which is a betrayal already, because the absolute risk reduction is less than 1%.
And if we
just take over this 90% and we perpetuate this betrayal, I think we mix up the people. We don't tell the truth.
I agree with you. Yes, absolutely. Yeah,
the number necessary to vaccine is more than 100.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, you know, it's become so bizarre for me as a scientist, because on one hand, there's the real message, right? Like that, like sort of the truthful way to relay the science, which is what you just pointed out when it comes to the vaccines. But then I find, you know, I am then using the public health messaging on the other hand to point out to people how crazy this is, right? How crazy the messaging is. So I agree with you 100% on what you just said, right? In the context of Canadians, though, I still point out this 90% and 95% because what they're being told is they're incredibly protective. And officially, the official message also is that now it only applies to the two doses, of course, but that officially we are being told that there's no such thing as breakthrough infections, right? If you're double vaccinated, that it's almost 0%. So in other words, completely protected. But then you have to look, like, so on my university campus, as I said, I'm not allowed on campus, right, for the next year. So we have a campus community that's at least 99% vaccinated, right? So we dramatically exceeded the goal of herd immunity if the vaccines were conferring immunity. And yet everybody still has to mask, physically distance, stand on these spots, you know, that are on the floor. They're told what doors to go in and out and when they can go in and out. We're even regulating on our campus the length of time that people can be unmasked to consume their food. It's kind of got so crazy that students have even been, it's even been recommended that they bring their drinks with straws so they can not unmask, but stick the straw up their mask.
You know, if scientists follow such a nonsense, they disqualify themselves for centuries. You cannot, yes. There's all the result coming from those people doing such a nonsense as a scientist. You needn't read them. You needn't read them. You just put them aside.
You know what? That is the big picture take-home message in terms of why I have continued to speak up throughout all of this, honestly, because I get late. Remarkably, my entire publication record is based on publishing about vaccines, novel vaccination strategies, and how to improve vaccination. All of the research funding that I hold is on the basis of developing novel vaccination strategies. Yet right now I'm being labeled an anti-vaxxer, remarkably. I'm actually a vaccine lover, but that's for vaccines that have been well vetted, have a great safety record, and are known to be highly effective, and where the risk-benefit ratio strongly would encourage their use. Not with this current batch of what we're calling COVID-19 vaccines, and this is the reason why I've actually spoken up, because I care about the field of vaccinology. And you're absolutely right. I feel that what we're doing right now is we are going to absolutely destroy people's confidence in the world's ability to practice vaccinology. We're going to lose faith in everybody, and we're going to start losing our footholds on some of the diseases that we've been controlling very well when we've been using vaccines that actually work properly. That's why I speak up. It's not to be controversial. It's because I actually want to defend my field, and I want to show the world that there are some of us who do understand how to practice vaccinology properly. Right, and assess the data critically.
I'm very fond of your position and what you do, and I'm only thinking that why didn't we notice this 10 years ago? Because the structures of the universities, the structure of science, the finances of science, all the money that goes to science is just an institutional corruption, a very big institutional corruption, setting the goals of science, setting the topics, what to make science on. Why did you make your work on vaccinations? There are so many immunological mechanisms and so many immunological facts we don't know and we should learn. And if you go to immunologists, they all deal with vaccinations. What a shit.
Yeah, well, your comment about our universities and colleges is absolutely true. I've seen this within my institution and all other institutions in Canada. Our administrators have been converted over time, over this period of time that you just mentioned, over the past decade, to business experts. Constantly. So when people are recruited into administrative positions in our universities, they're the people who have, you know, a strong business experience and a history of training in business, they're the ones that are being recruited. More and more are so literally our administrations are being stocked up with people who are you know, have great business expertise, and we're running more and more, obviously, because if you start bringing in people who have spent their careers dealing in the world of business, it just makes sense that the academic institutions, therefore, are going to start functioning more and more like businesses.
Yeah, exactly.
And this is where our institutions in Canada are set up more and more as time goes on. We're being set up more and more to function like businesses.
Yes. And there is a crossover or a revolving door effect, I guess you can call it, between the businesses and our what we consider public institutions. Mm-hmm. If you look at the EMA, the European Medical Agency, I think is what it stands for, the woman who runs it is a former pharma lobbyist. And this is not an isolated case. This is what we're seeing everywhere. They have infiltrated all of our public institutions. They have, in fact, taken them over. It's a huge hostile takeover. And what we used to consider independent science is now for sale. Science is for sale, basically. The only way to get out of this, I think, is to expose all of this, to make this publicly known. And that's what we're doing. That's what you're doing as well. That's also what John Olooney did or is doing when he talks about what he sees in his work as an undertaker. And that's also what Dr. Shimon Janowitz is doing. And the judge who there's a Portuguese judge whom we interviewed at the beginning of our today's session. He was very outspoken. You can see him in a video. We're going to mail it to you. He is, as a judge, addressing a group of police officers who were ready to beat up people because they were not wearing their masks correctly. They were wearing their masks, except not really correctly. And he was confronting them. He's a brave man. And he says, I haven't watched any television for the last 7 years, so I'm not really, it's not easy to, for this propaganda to work on me. And as you said, we have to take off the kid gloves, because I do think we have reached a point at which it doesn't make any sense for us anymore to pretend that maybe they're making mistakes over on the other side. These are no mistakes. There's intent behind this. There's intent behind this. There's a plan behind this. There's an agenda they're pushing, and they're using this agenda to Corona in order to divert our attention from what's really going on.
I totally agree. Yes.
What I also think is very interesting, you mentioned these two papers that are basically unscientific. And, from these papers, everything starts to be rolled out to the public, or like it's the basis for the political decisions. And then we have this, our Drosten paper, the Coleman Drosten, the paper that kind of initiated the PCR test, which is also flawful. We have this letter or this review that 22 scientists did on this Drosten paper, and they found, I think, 10 major flaws in it. So it's like also not based in reality.
Not minor mistakes, major flaws that no mistake that an undergraduate student would make.
And also the Lancet study, with this one person like receiving all the treatment and passing away. And that's the basis for like treatment of so many people. I mean, it seems that maybe that's also like a concerted or whatever, like a synchronized activity, that you have one unscientific paper popping up in one magazine, and then everyone makes reference to that and bases all their decisions on it. It's very strange.
In Canada, that's what our public health officials do. They'll put down one reference, and it might look legitimate to the average person because they see a reference there. I was just talking about this yesterday. In Ontario, we have this fear-mongering going on right now with the Delta variant, and which does seem to be more contagious for sure, but as I put it as well, having evaluated the data, it's more contagious but far less dangerous.
Yeah.
And I mean, the common cold, as they point out to people, is highly contagious, but a mere nuisance for most people. Yeah. And remarkably, in this case, the entire justification Ontario for for really pushing this fear on people so that they can justify their vaccine mandates, and especially as they go down, try and go down in children, you know, younger and younger with the children now. And it's all based, and again, Ontario, on a preprint article done by a person who served on our an advisory committee that was really pushing all of these mandates. Again, and remarkably, this is going to be surprising, right? It's, again, based on an epidemiological model. And we asked, so it's a preprint. So we asked, another scientist that I know of asked for the raw data. And couldn't be provided. The author actually said that it isn't actually my data to give you. It belongs to the Ontario Scientific Advisory Table, which again is this committee that advises our provincial government on all their policies. And so then the Scientific Advisory Committee was contacted. And they said, we don't know about this data set. We don't even know about this preprint article that you're talking about, right? So again, it's a case of, it's all based on this, and it's come out in the news. This is the basis for our major news stories right now. And and this was put into a video that's, quotes, educating all the teachers in our province. Again, based on garbage science. Every time the three of you bring up questions and stuff, I could talk for hours and hours about, and you keep bringing up all these things that I would love to be able to share. I know we don't have the time, but a couple key things, because this should be based on the science. And you're absolutely right. As a scientist, I can tell you, talking about the science, like, of course I'm going to do it. And yeah, I think, I've been doing a half decent job of educating the public. But in terms of the power brokers that be, that set these policies, the science doesn't matter. I can say all the science that I want, and it's clear. And everything that I talk about is based on the science. But I want to give you a couple of examples, because this is very important. Just make sure you're aware. So in many countries, including Canada, the basis for pushing so rapidly these COVID-19 vaccines upon pregnant females, for example, a critical foundation for that was an article that was published in the New England Journal of Medicine. So this is a very well-respected medical journal. They look specifically at the rate of miscarriages. And they had two groups. One was a group of women who had been vaccinated. And then the other group, the control group, were those who were unvaccinated. In this, they concluded that the miscarriage rate was not significantly above that of the control group. Therefore, this was critical evidence showing that the vaccines were safe in pregnant females, and all kinds of policies were made, right? Our licensing body for obstetricians and gynecologists in Canada, right? Their licensing body immediately, officially was promoting the vaccination of pregnant women based on this, and it has happened around the world. So it's been a foundation for a lot of countries' policies. What a lot of people don't realize, so a group of collaborators that I work with, I wasn't involved in this particular collaboration, but I know all the people who were involved. And one of them, for example, you would know is Dr. Peter McCullough.
Yeah.
And good on him and the other scientists who got together. They put together a letter to the editor of the journal, because again, they looked at it and found an obvious and simple mathematical error that led to this erroneous conclusion about safety. So they tried very hard to get their letter to the editor published. The editor of the New England Journal of Medicine would not allow it to be published. Now, in part because they recalculated, so they used the same, they applied the mathematical principles that this group intended to use, but pointed out that the denominator and the equation that they used was completely wrong, wrong. And but using the same basic principles and therefore correcting the denominator, they showed that instead of the treatment group, rather than the miscarriage rate being about 14%, they found that it was 83%. And keep in mind that for the control group was at 12%.
Whoa.
Right? So 12 versus 14. So that's where they concluded, the authors concluded, there's no evidence of, there's no safety signal here. They found 83%. But so they weren't allowed to publish that. So the editor would not accept that new number. But what they did do is they did make the authors go back and look into this harsh criticism of the math. And the authors, of course, because it was obvious. It was obvious to all of us who looked at this paper. Like you mentioned, again, clear errors being allowed. And a major publication that's forming, that's the foundation for policies. And so you need to be aware of this. So the authors, therefore, they looked at this, and again, it was obvious, and since they were called out on it, they were forced to publish a comment on the paper. Remarkably, they weren't forced to change the wording and the conclusions, but they were forced to publish a comment. It's very hard to find. If you look up this article in the New England Journal of Medicine, on the page at the top, very top, there's a little bar they've added which says comments, and then beside it, there's a tiny little number one, meaning there's been one comment on the paper published. And that's the only thing. If you click on this tiny little number one, it's a clickable link. Then it takes you to the published correction to the article. It is very, you have to be a scientist to have any chance. Even as scientists, they've written it in such a way where it's very discombobulated. But as a scientist who has expertise in this area, you know, myself and all the others with expertise in this area can tell you clearly the message is they had to admit that the denominator they had used was incorrect. And they in fact have, so rather than using a denominator that Peter McCullough and his colleagues had you know, suggested they use, they simply concluded, so we don't know what the denominator should be. And they left it at that. And then, so in other words, it is an open admission that they have, in other words, they cannot conclude. So of course, Peter McCullough and his colleagues were trying to get the message out there, like this actually shows that it's dangerous. But again, I point out, so they were very frustrated that that couldn't get out there. But to me, it's almost an equal success in terms of them ensuring the science is correct, because the onus should never be on us to prove the dangers of the vaccines, right? And rather the people pushing them, the onus is on them to prove they're safe. Of course. And this publication now can no longer be used to demonstrate that these vaccines are safe in pregnant women. And yet none of the policies have changed. We're in fact worse, right? We're now mandating around the world that pregnant females receive this, and it's based on this foundation that has been removed, that's crumbled. So that safety paper, quote safety paper, no longer exists to be able to support that. It's incredible. And the other thing, because again, I like to talk about the science, and that's what I base all of my comments on. Ryan, you mentioned something that triggered an interesting story that I've become aware of when you were talking about somebody who, you know, who has not paid attention to mainstream media. So I don't know if you've seen this. So I actually have it sitting right beside me. It's a paper in a respected journal called Toxicology Reports.
Yeah.
And this just came out. And the first author here, Ronald Kostoff. Mm-hmm. I had the privilege every Thursday. There's a group of international scientists and physicians that get together. There's about 12 of us. One of them is Dr. Peter McCullough. Another one is Dr. Robert Malone, one of the inventors of the messenger RNA vaccine technology. And two Thursdays ago, in this meeting, there were three people in that meeting who were representing three independent research groups who have been doing intensive cost-benefit analyses using adverse event reporting systems. And most of these groups have been using the VAERS database, Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System, in the United States. Mm-hmm. And we brought onto the call this scientist, Ron Kostoff. He is a great guy. We actually wanted to know what his experience was in publishing this paper, because you have to. I'll just hold it up again so actually anybody can, you know, pause and get the information here. Mm-hmm. Because you need to look up this paper. You need to read this paper if you haven't. This absolutely strips down to the bone and unveils the all of the problems with these COVID-19 vaccines. It is an incredible takedown of these vaccines. And what I want to point out is, because I also like to go with the weight of the evidence. So this is an incredible publication to look at. But my point here is we had three other groups represented in this call. So with him on the call, that meant four. They all have done completely independent analyses and have all come to the exact same broad conclusions that the COVID-19 vaccines are doing far more harm than good. And there's a fifth group as well that we weren't involved in this call, but a fifth group, and they have published a paper as well, which is also in agreement. So that paper that was published was it shows that for every life saved with these vaccines, it's costing two lives. Yeah. Okay. And with these other groups, the numbers vary, but what we found is the numbers vary from about a ratio of 2-1 up to 5-1 on average across age groups. So, but they all are in uniform. So it's 5 independent research groups. 2 of them have now published. So this one, and this is why it's interesting. This is where it links in. This Ron Kostoff, he's 83 years old. He shared with us that he's, you know, he intentionally has stayed out of the, you know, a lot of the modern technology. So he couldn't even join us. He couldn't join us in our Zoom meeting because he didn't have access to Zoom. He couldn't even call in with a smartphone so that we could talk really coherently. Instead, one of the participants had to hold his phone up to his microphone. Mm-hmm. And then when we wanted to communicate with him, the person holding the phone had to then pick up the phone and communicate, relay the question to him. So that's how we were communicating. And so he didn't realize the significance of this publication because he's not involved with the mainstream media. He actually didn't realize how incredibly controversial this paper is. We told him that he's our new superhero. He said, "What do you mean? I'm doing nothing different, right? I'm just doing what I've done my entire career. I just published scientific truths." He actually did not realize, because he's not involved with the mainstream media, how controversial this is and how against the current narrative this paper is. And I'll just summarize it here very quickly. If you look at the abstract, you don't have to understand the science in detail, but if you look at the two sentences here at the end of the abstract, this is what they tell you. And this to me tells it all. So in the highest risk demographic, and in this paper, what they define that as is people 65 years and older. So keep this in mind. This is the highest risk demographic. Now, notice the title's focusing on children, because that's where all of us can be in agreement that the cost-benefit analysis gets to an extreme, ridiculous extreme, because COVID-19 is just not much of an issue, much of a problem in children. But So what they start off with is the highest risk demographic to make their point. In the highest risk demographic, with their cost-benefit analysis, they found that for every life saved with a COVID-19 vaccine, 5 were being lost. So in other words, there's not even a foundation for recommending these vaccines in the highest risk demographic. And then, of course, this imbalance explodes as you go down in age, because the risk associated with COVID-19 plummets, such that they can't even really, they can't come close to getting an accurate estimate of what it would look like in children. They just conclude that for children, it's likely more than 100 deaths associated with these vaccines for every life saved. Right. So this is why you need to look at this. And in fact, what I find unbelievable, you know, there's two reasons why I got attacked when I raised the issue about the biodistribution study. And that also is something which links into directly what you said, Reiner. You talked about the EMA, the European Medicines Agency, mm-hmm. and their report seemed to really downplay this biodistribution data. So I was shocked when, you know, so we found out that the Japanese government, you know, requires, they ask for more what we call preclinical data from the vaccine manufacturers than other health regulatory agencies. And so it was very frustrating to see that the Japanese government had this very detailed biodistribution study, and in the European Medicines Agency report, and this plays into what your comment about them and how they're being run, right? Toned it all down, put it all into text, brief text. So it never really set off the alarm bells, right? And it wasn't until we actually saw the hard data displayed in a table, right, being able to see the actual numbers, that we got that's where the alarm bells really went off. And that's when we realized that these vaccines are not functioning like traditional vaccines at all. But the point is, So I got really attacked for raising that issue. The other one, which I just want to point out because it's interesting, is people accused me of being overly dramatic in referring to the spike protein as a toxin. And what I just want to point out in this...
Everyone agrees with this, because that is what they pointed out to...
that's just it. And this is the incredible thing in this paper. They list issues with the vaccine, right? And again, this is why. So again, it's published. Here it is, the published science. I just want to show, because it's incredible now to see. Point number one, when they talk about, you know, the issues that they were focusing on here. Point number one, I don't know if you can see this, but they're staying right there. The spike protein is a toxin.
Yeah.
It's a toxin. Yeah. There it is. right?
Well, that's why they invented the vaccines in the first place, to protect against this most dangerous ingredient of the so-called dangerous virus, to protect against the spike protein. And now they're injecting the spike protein directly into people's bodies.
Exactly. This is why there's two reasons why I tend to focus on the children and not the elderly. Although now with this paper in hand, I have no problem talking about the elderly as well, the highest risk demographic. But first of all, because it's acknowledged that the problem with COVID-19 is certainly not substantial in this demographic. But what you just pointed out, Reiner, a lot of people don't realize children, one of the reasons why it's not much of a problem for children have an inherent, essentially protection. They have this inherent protection from infection. The reason is, in adults, our airways, our respiratory system is loaded with the receptor that the virus uses to attach to our cells, right? It's called the ACE2 receptor. We express much higher concentrations of that in our respiratory system than children do. So children have this inherent protection. I like to view it as, like a good analogy is if you're trying to climb a cliff, if you're doing free rock climbing, if you have lots of handholds and footholds, toe holds, you're going to be able to climb up that cliff pretty efficiently, right? For kids and their airways, they're lacking a lot of these hand and toe holds, right? And so the virus has a much harder time literally grabbing on to their cells and infecting them. And so they're protected that way. But so by putting the spike protein into the body, we're actually bypassing this natural protective mechanism that they have. And this is the issue. They have, they're getting the same doses as adults. And internally, once you get past the respiratory system, these receptors are expressed at the same level as you see in adults, because it's not a protein that's designed to be a receptor for the virus. It serves basic fundamental physiological functions in the body. So, exactly. Through natural exposure, they are at much less risk from the spike protein. It can't grab onto their cells as easily. But once you bypass that, and if you get the spike protein into the body, now it's got all the footholds and handholds that the adults have on their cells.
Oh, man. It's insanity. It's insanity. Yes, this is not science anymore. It's insanity. But it's because we have to look the real facts into the eye, so to speak. We have to see what's really going on. This has nothing to do with health. It's completely different. It's a completely different agenda. And I mean, it's of course, it makes it extremely difficult for normal people who have been exposed to the mainstream media for too long to understand what's really going on. Because if they really look at the facts that we're seeing right now, and that we've been seeing on this Corona Committee, we've been speaking to so many experts, and even though I'm of course not I'm not a doctor, but I have as what's his name, Justice, the Supreme Court Justice, English Supreme Court Justice, Sir, I forget his name. He said we all have a head to make use of. It's good for more than just putting a hat on it. And if you listen to science the way you explain it, or the way Wolfgang Wodak explains it, all of us can have our own opinions on this. Of course, we can't know any of these scientific details unless we either talk to one of you or read up on this. But we all have a mind and a brain which is helpful in making up on our own mind.
That's exactly to me, it has become so obvious. You don't need deep expertise in any of the areas of specialty that directly apply to this pandemic at the moment. One thing that I think really speaks volumes, Reiner, and all this is. So I've been a member of a whole bunch of different international collaborative groups, and also personally on my own. I have now offered or have had on my behalf offers made to literally thousands of people around the world, thousands of scientists, especially a lot of the naysayers, the people who are censoring us, the people who are saying that we are providing misinformation, literally to thousands around the world. In the United States, there's been most recently, there has been a very public invitation made to the Centers for Disease Control and also the Food and Drug Administration to engage in respectful but open and public scientific discussions, right? The argument being, rather than having all these fact checkers attack us on little snippets of things that we put in print or things that we say in interviews, because as a scientist, I can tell you, it's a relatively easy task if you want to start picking apart little sound bites that other scientists are saying, especially to lay people. It's much different if you are interacting in real time with a scientist where they can respond in real time, right? They can see where you're going with a certain comment and they can adjust for that with the new information. Very different to interact with a scientist in that way. That is the way scientists traditionally operate, scholars in general, right? Was open discussions and being open to different viewpoints. And as I've always said, right, iron sharpens iron. And it's a case of allowing that process to happen and see where the chips may fall, right? So literally, we have so much science now dealing with COVID-19. And so literally, what we need to do, we should be doing, is seeing where's the weight of the science? Where's exactly the weight of the science on, exactly, on every issue, on every, yeah, issue, right? And this is not happening. And so university, for all this huge collaborative network I'm in, and myself, literally there have been invitations now that have gone out to likely hundreds of thousands of people, and not one person will engage in this type of discussion. Not one of my colleagues, no scientist or physician anywhere in the world will even talk to me on the phone, talk to me in a Zoom meeting one-on-one, let alone in public. And this has to start telling the public something, right? The public keeps telling, don't listen to these people. They're just telling you lies. And they seem so confident with what they write that we're absolutely wrong. So I'm thinking, and yet then on the other hand, they'll be really upset because they'll accuse us of indirectly leading, you know, killing people because of the lies that we're putting out there in public. Yeah. So you can on one hand say these people are causing lots of damage, but it's all because of lies. But we're not going to show you how they're lying in a real time discussion with these people, right? If you're so confident that we're wrong. I mean, if I was so confident that somebody was wrong, I would have no problem, and I feel they're doing much harm to the world, I'd have no problem getting on, you know, in a public forum to have a respectful, moderated discussion and crush the person based on, if I knew that I had the weight of the science in my favor, because then they're done, their voice is done, and you've shown definitively where the fallacies are, right, that they're relaying to the public, but not one person and all this time has been willing to do that with me or any of the many, many colleagues that I now have around the world.
I know.
Right?
I know.
Don't need to be a scientist to see that is a major, major problem.
It's very obvious, and I think it's all coming out into the open, and that is the only positive net result of all of this, that it's all coming out into the open. How we have been manipulated, not just over the last year and a half. Because, you know, had somebody told me what was going to happen over these last 15 or 18 months or so, had somebody told me this at the beginning of 2020, I would have told him to take his pills and go see a doctor. But we're running out of conspiracy theories. They're all coming true. And even those of us who are very calm and don't like to be very outspoken, including our friend Professor Martin Schwab, who's our most important legal advisor, the University of Bielefeld, even he says, I don't believe anything anymore unless I can check up on it. Well, Byram, I could go on like this for quite a while because it's so interesting to hear everything. Can you, Wolfgang just asked me, can you give us the sources? Can you, for example, this article that you have shown us, can you scan it and email it to us?
Yes, I can.
Absolutely. Great. 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 I would love to keep on talking to you, but there'll be another time. There's Paul Alexander is now with us, who's been waiting. I think he only has 30 minutes to talk to us. So if you like, just stay online and listen in.
I'd love to. Yeah. Paul and I know one another well, actually. He's fabulous. I love listening to him, so if that's okay, I will listen in.
Great, very good.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you.